There's an interesting passage of scripture found in Matthew chapter 6. Let's go over there for a moment this afternoon as we prepare for the sermon. Matthew chapter 6, which we understand coupled along with Matthew chapter 5, and again Matthew chapter 6 and Matthew chapter 7 are all part of the Sermon on the Mount. There is no chapter break in the original writings. Again, those were put in centuries later when manuscripts were all put together. And we understand as we look at the writings here, the understanding from Matthew 5, 6, and 7, it all pieces together in this very meaningful, the words of Jesus Christ on the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5 as he goes through the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 6 as he deals with spiritual disciplines of giving, of prayer, and of fasting, and of course Matthew chapter 7, he talks about a number of other things. Beware of those that come in sheep's clothing that are actually wolves, and again concluding it by talking about that story of the individual who likened someone who did not follow the teaching as someone who built their house on sand rather than building on the rock by doing those things that were spoken of in the message that he gave here in chapters 5, 6, and 7. But here in Matthew chapter 6, we find something very interesting. I want to use it as the backdrop for the introduction to the sermon this afternoon. Notice Matthew chapter 6 beginning in verse 1. Matthew chapter 6 beginning in verse 1, he says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them, otherwise you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward." Verse 3, "But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly." Reward you openly. So again, the understanding when it comes to giving and what one should do, not to be like the hypocrites, not wanting to be seen of men, wanting to see what a wonderful, a charitable person, charitable individual I am, so that they can get their praise of men. But he makes the statement, we do it privately, we do it in secret. And then he concludes in verse 4 by saying, "And he," speaking of God, "the Father, will himself reward you openly." In verse 5, he then begins to talk about praying and not to pray as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets so that they can be seen by men. But notice what he says in verse 6. Notice what he says in verse 6 when he's talking about praying. He says, "But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." So now we have the second spiritual discipline, that being prayer. And the point that Jesus Christ is making here is that when you offer up that prayer, don't be like those hypocrites in the street. They are seen in the synagogues. They are seen in the corners. They want to be seen of men. And as he says there in verse 5, they have their reward. But he said, when you pray, do it in secret before your Father, and he will reward you openly. The third area that Jesus Christ would go to, we pick it up in verse 17, where he talks about the hypocrites. Now, the hypocrites would go out in the street, and they would be fasting, and they would put that makeup on their face, this white, pasty makeup, to make themselves appear pale. And it was done so that people could see that they were fasting. Look how righteous this person is because they must be fasting. Jesus addressed that and he says, don't be like those individuals. Notice verse 17, he says, "But you, when you fast," Matthew chapter 6, verse 17, "when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." Three times with the three disciplines of giving, of prayer, and of fasting, Jesus Christ, when he concluded what a Christian, a true follower of his teaching should do, he finishes with that statement, "He shall reward you openly." I'd like to address that today. And I'd like to ask the question in the sermon, what does it mean, he shall reward you openly? What does it mean, he shall reward you openly? Now, we think of that particular term, and you're thinking probably right away, well, I know right away what it is. But do we? Do we? You know, it's interesting if you take a look at your Bible. I've got I believe it's a King James, New King James Version Nelson Bible. And in my Bible, in each one of those cases, in verses 4, in verse 6, and in verse 18, where the statement is made, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly, there is an asterisk that is there. Now, that asterisk behind that statement takes you to a marginal reference. And the marginal reference will say that it is not in the NU or the critical Greek text. Now, this is a statement that's been made by the work of men using four manuscripts instead of the 5,000-year-old Byzantine Greek text. So when we take a look at what the true text is, we see that this phrase that is used, reward you openly, is actually a phrase that is part of the original text. It is there. It is important that we understand that it's there and it means something. So what does it mean? What do we learn from this particular statement? He shall reward you openly. Now, again, I think part of that is we take a look at this passage of Scripture and we say, well, you take a look at mainstream Christianity today, and man is always trying to impress with outward forms of religion. He is trying to impress with long, exhaustive prayers or getting into rituals of a form that lack any substance. If you've ever been to a Catholic church, and again, I know that some may have come out of the Catholic church before they were called by God into the true church. I've had a chance to attend a Catholic church before. I observed, I did not actually participate in the service itself, but to observe what was going on. And it is, again, one of those things that is long on form, but it lacks any substance. But you see that this is what man does. He gets involved in these long, exhaustive ritual prayers or ritual forms of service that lack any substance. We see these massive cathedrals that exist. Especially if you go into Europe and you see some of those cathedrals that have existed for century upon century. Very old, very ornate, and you know, very intricate in terms of their architecture. This is their form of religion. But when it came to looking at the things from the appearance of things, as Jesus Christ was talking about the way to give and the way to pray and the way to fast, he makes that statement over and over again. He says, they have the glory of men. Those that would seek to pray in the corners of the streets or in the synagogue so they could be seen, they have the glory of men. They have their reward. Well, this is, again, one of the meanings that we come to understand about what man does. We understand there is something greater that we can draw from the three spiritual disciplines of giving, of prayer, and of fasting. If we understand what they are, then it will help us to build and enhance those disciplines in our spiritual lives. It's one thing to understand and know that we are to do these things, to give. We could talk about tithing or giving of offerings. We know that we are to pray. We know that we are to fast. But when we understand fully and completely and we can build on them, when we understand what this statement means, and he shall reward you openly. First of all, we need to understand something before we get into the specifics here, and that is that all of these acts that I speak about, whether it is giving, whether it is prayer, or whether it is fasting, they are all personal and very private Christian exercises. Nobody from headquarters sends me a spreadsheet once a week that I meet you at the door and I say name, and I take a look at your name and see if you have been tithing this past week. There is no relationship of that from the standpoint of the church and the individual. It's an understanding that we realize that's part of a discipline that we are to do, that we are commanded to do. But it's personal between the individual and God. Likewise, I don't sit there and have a questionnaire and ask you before you come through the door, well, how many times have you prayed this week? And for how long have you prayed this week? Again, personal relationship between the individual and between God. And again, when it comes to fasting, I don't ask you how many times, other than the Day of Atonement, have you fasted this year? because this is all personal. These acts are all personal driven. They are private exercises between the person and between God. It is, however, where these Christian disciplines are developed that we come to understand that through these disciplines, the three that I mentioned here in Matthew chapter 6, we build a foundation. We build a foundation, and from that foundation, we begin to grow into the faith. Now, you can say that from a very literal standpoint, looking at it, just think of the point when you were called, when you were first baptized, and your prayer life, maybe that first month or two after you were baptized, compared to where it might be now 20, 30, 40 years later. I dare say it's much different now than it was back then because it has been built, it has been enhanced over time. So these are the things that we need to think about when we think about these three disciplines, but also this question of what does it mean he shall reward you openly? At the beginning, before we get into some of this, let's consider 8 points. I want to give you 8 points to ponder. And again, as I mentioned to Eugene this morning, I will speak slowly so that you can write them all down, lest I get in trouble from anybody who writes slowly or anybody who I share a last name with who will beat me up later. That's not my wife who I'm speaking of. So here are 8 points that we want to ponder. Number one, when it comes to these spiritual disciplines, okay? Number one, we communicate with the creator of the universe. We communicate with the creator of the universe. We are talking to God, the Father. Now again, we are talking with him. It's one of my pet peeves when someone gives a prayer and they start with, "Dear Lord." I'm like, why are you writing a letter? That's what you do when you're writing a letter to somebody. Dear so-and-so. Dear mom and dad, college is great. Please send more money. When we pray, we are not writing a letter to God. We are conversing with him. We are communicating with the creator of the universe. So that's the first point we need to ponder with regard to the spiritual disciplines. Number two. We are developing patterns of behavior. We are developing patterns of behavior built on faith responses. Now, what is a pattern of behavior? A pattern of behavior is when you know every day at such and such a time, you sit down and you do the following. Or once a month, you have dedicated a day aside for fasting. Or whenever it is specifically that you pay your tithes, it's always that same time. For me, when it comes to paying tithes, when I pay for my wife and myself, it is, again, the first bill that is paid when we are paid. It's the first thing that gets paid for. Someone says, well, I've got financial troubles. And I say, well, start with the first thing. You've got to give your tithe, pay your tithes first, and then everything falls in line from there. So we develop this pattern of behavior, whether it's prayer, whether it's giving, whether it's fasting. And we build these patterns of behavior built on faith responses. We'll get into that in a little bit later. Number three, once we have these patterns of behavior, we develop habits of character. Habits of character. Now, what do we mean by habits of character? The habits of character are there for life's experiences and situations that are thrown at us. See, once you have developed the discipline, the three disciplines that Jesus Christ was speaking about here in Matthew chapter 6, we have the ability then to weather the experiences and situations that are thrown at us. The things that, again, will develop the character in us. We develop these habits of character as an end result of the things that come at us and how we react and how we deal with them. Early on, we might have been baptized. Early on, we might have been dealing with something. Something was comes at us and we're freaking out, physically thinking, humanly speaking, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Over time of that relationship and building that relationship with God, we come to a point of having a habit of character when the life experience or situation is thrown at us. We know exactly what we have to do. We have to go before God in prayer. We have to go before God in fasting and prayer to come to a knowledge of an understanding of how to deal with a particular situation. Number four, Number four, as we begin to do these things, a wonderful relationship is built. So we have begin to have this deeper relationship with the creator of the universe that is developed over time, and this wonderful relationship is built. We know that we can come to him in time of need. We know that we can come to him at time of thanksgiving. We know those things, and that relationship is there because we know that he hears us. And so this relationship is built. Number five, a spiritual maturity then grows. A spiritual maturity then grows. We move from an element of what we call faith to faith. Now, what do I mean by that? We move from an element of human faith to godly faith. In other words, we move from a point of figuring we can figure it all out ourselves, humanly speaking. I have faith in my abilities, to coming to the point where we understand we have to have a relationship with God and a dependency on God to see us through those things. And we rely upon that, and we don't question that. See, that's moving from a human relationship of faith to a godly relationship of faith. It's a different type of faith. It's what we grow in. Number six, then, we find the next point is that we have communication from the Creator. Right? He doesn't talk to us in words, but he talks to us in the things and the actions that we receive. We end up finding out that the answer to our prayers, whatever it might be, we find that the blessings that come as an end result of tithing, that's communication that's coming back from the Creator. When we've asked for something, and again, as we'll see a little bit later, if it's asked according to his will, he's going to grant that if it's according to his will. Not necessarily in our time frame, which we learn that his time frame and our time frame are not the same because ours is human. His is godly. So communication comes back from the Creator. Number seven, we begin to develop a godly esteem as a worthy child of God. There's a basic human understanding that human beings want to feel needed. You know, some people say, well, I could just go away. I'm an introvert. I could never see another human being and I'd be fine with it. Well, yes and no. Because even the most hardcore introvert still wants to have that self-esteem. They want to feel worthy. So as we go through this relationship with God, as we develop these disciplines, we come to understand that we develop godly esteem as a worthy child of God. A worthy child of God. And then finally, number eight, the eighth point to ponder. We come to an understanding of praying, thy will be done. Thy will be done. See, within the prayers and within the asking, it's always, I need the following. I'm laying this before your feet. But how many of us consider at that particular moment in time the example that Jesus Christ gives us, where at the Garden of Gethsemane, when he is in deep distress because he understands and realizes the physical anguish that is there, that in that one gospel account, I'm thinking it's Luke, that it records that literally there were drops of blood as he offers up this prayer, asking if there's any other way that this cup could pass from him. But how does he conclude that prayer to God? Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. So when we get this relationship, we come to an understanding of praying, whatever it is, thy will be done. You know, we find that there's an example of giving and of responses, which is quite interesting. Quite interesting. I shared an example last Feast of Tabernacles in one of the sermons that I gave, and I'll share it again. So for those of you that heard it, just bear with me, as for those that did not hear it, because it applies very well. It's an example of giving and the response. And sometimes that response is not necessarily what it should be. My father tells a story of a farmer that he was visiting with. And the farmer was complaining because he says, I am broke. He says, I'm giving all this tithe. I'm giving all this money to the church. He says, I don't have any money. He says, I don't even have enough money that I could go to town and get a haircut at the barber. And so my father sat down with him and he said, okay, got out a piece of paper and a pen. He says, let's take a look at what your assets are. Let's see what you've got. And they sat down and he took a look. He said, well, I've seen this acreage. How many acres do you have? He said, well, I've got a section over here and I've got another half section or a section over here. It turned out to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,200 acres, roughly. He said, well, what's that worth? My father said, what's that worth in terms of a present day value per acre? So the man told him and did the math and everything, put that down. He said, okay. He said, what about your farm machinery you've got here? You've got this combine, you've got this tractor, you've got this thrasher, you've got this farm equipment. What's all that worth? So they added it all up and he said, so what's is there a bank loan against the farm machinery? And the farmer said, no, I own it free and clear. He said, well, what about the acreage that you have, this 1,200 acres? Is there still a loan you're paying on the acreage? He says, no, I own it free and clear. He said, when I came in, I saw all these bales of hay. You got massive numbers of bales of hay. He says, how many bales of hay do you have there and what are they worth per bale? And so they figured it all out and figured out what the dollar number was. He put it down. He said, but that's only that type of hay. I have this other hay. It's called Timothy hay. It's a more sought after hay. It's more expensive. Well, how many bales of that do you have? And he figured it all out and added it all up. So they added everything up. And of course, he had some head of cattle and all the cattle. What if you took that to market, what would it be worth? And all these various. And at the end of it all, they added all these things up. Now, again, remember, this is back in the 1960s. And they figured out that the man was worth over $1 million. So my father's advice was take a cow, go sell it at the market, put some money in your pocket and go get a haircut. I mean, he was asset rich, but he was cash poor. But in his mind, he had given all this money and God hasn't been blessing me. I can't even get a haircut. Well, when somebody sat down with him, showed them the other side of the story, yeah, you've been tremendously blessed. Not a lot of people out there that could say that they own 1,200 acres free and clear. And all of their equipment and all the various assets they had free and clear. There's another story of a farmer, and again, I mentioned this a little bit in the Bible study a few weeks back about angels. You've got prairie fires that will come and rush through the prairies, and if you've ever been in the prairies, you know that because the wind always blows. It never stops blowing on the prairies. And so this man saw this fire. It was coming in the distance. It was a prairie fire, and it was moving rather rapidly, 8 to 10 feet high. And it was coming right at his house. So he had the farmstead house, but outside the farmstead house in the little plot of ground that they had these massively high trees that had been planted some time back. And of course, they were, what, about 15, 20 feet high that sort of served as a windbreak around the house. And here's this massive fire coming in. And that fire went all the way up the trees and stopped. Took care of the trees, but it did not get to the house. And again, the man made the statement again, the realization that he had just ended up tithing earlier that week. So he's drawing a correlation in his mind between the fact that he had been obedient in giving his tithe, and here was God who had blessed him. I'm talking here about an example of giving and response. Let's turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 11. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 11. In Malachi chapter 3, actually in verse 9 or verse 8, the individual, Malachi is sitting here talking about robbing God. He's talking about robbing him in tithe and in offerings. And he talks about being cursed. And he says in verse 10, he talks about the fact, bring all your tithes. And he's going to make certain and sure that you are taken care of, that, as it says in verse 10, there may be food in my house. And try me now and see if I won't do that, that I will bless you so much there will not even be room enough to receive it, as he says there, the latter part of verse 10. But I want you to notice verse 11. He says, and I will rebuke the devourer for your sake, so that he will not destroy the fruit of your ground, nor shall the vine fail to bear fruit for you in the field, says the Lord of hosts. There's another story yet again of another farmer in Alberta who had the same situation of again, a prairie fire. The neighbor says the fire moved to the south and burned about 10 acres of land, but saved that flock of the 80 sheep that he had, plus all the grain that he needed to feed the sheep through the winter months. When you look at verse 11 here, it says, I'll rebuke the devourer. Now, we look at that, it's an agricultural statement that Malachi is making because they would understand that. It has to do with an insect infestation. But the principle is the same, is it not? When you take a look at prairie fire that comes across and could destroy somebody's property, but there's a response, again, giving, and a response by God coming back saying, try me. In this case, I will protect that which is yours. I will protect that which is yours. There's other examples that people have in terms of the giving and the response mechanism. Several stories here. Let me share just a few of them with you, going all the way back to the Worldwide Church of God many, many decades ago. Let me share this letter received by a coworker, someone who is actually new in the faith. Person writes the letter, says the following, says, recently I started tithing. The first week it only took a few dollars out of my ample check to tithe. The next week I cashed my check, and again, as I had done the first week, bought a money order for the tithe. This time my cashed check was stolen, but I paid my tithe anyway. The following week's check was short. Apart from the tithe, I had to pay a bank loan, rent, and light bill. I just paid the tithe and rent and let everything else slide. Then I was laid off work. One check had to last 3 weeks before I had a job again. To make a long story short, I had a $100 fine to pay plus all of my regular bills. That made that month a real struggle. Despite the crisis, the person writes, I tithed on every check. Now, only 2 months later, my fine is paid off, the bank loan has been paid 5 months in advance, and I am moving out of my little apartment where I paid a good price for rent plus electricity into a house where the rent is only half the cost of the apartment and the utilities are paid. To put it mildly, I have been blessed. Please take this money order. I can afford it. You begin to see and understand what we mean by building a response and building a relationship based upon the response of giving. The individual wasn't expecting something in return, but at the end of it all, they were blessed as an end result of what they did. Let's take a look at another example. This time we find an example of praying and the response. Praying and the response. The writer writes the following. He says, I would like to share an incident which happened to me at work at a coal mine several days ago. As I was leaving the job one day, the foreman started throwing questions at me such as, they tell me you don't work on Saturday. Why? I replied, religious reasons. His response, what religion? I told him my church's name. He then grabbed me by the throat and threw me on the mine floor. With the cold edge of his knife at my throat, he began cursing me. I managed to get my hand on his forehead and push him off, but knew if he got me down again, he would kill me. I uttered a silent prayer, and immediately he started fighting something other than myself and something I could not see. He began to vomit and cry violently and kept it up for several minutes. He then crawled to the other side of the mine. The way God saved my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that He is faithful in keeping His promises. If you can't see that that is intervention in response to praying, I don't know what's going on in your mind right now, because that's not coincidence. As the individual said, clearly he was fighting something else. Well, yeah, he was fighting a guardian angel that was giving him all he could handle. Here's another story. Again, an example of praying in the response. It seems that always before the feast, anything that can go wrong does around our house. In less than 2 weeks, my sewing machine malfunctioned. My tire went flat. The freezer and washer both went out of order. The dryer door hinges broke, etc., etc., etc. Just a lot of irritating things that you just fix and keep on trucking. I had taken it all in stride and just kept hoping to go to the feast. Then one day, while preparing supper, I went to the freezer, which was working again, and reached on top to get the only key we owned to unlock it. Somehow the key just bounced right out of my hand. I tried to catch it as it fell and watched in total surprise as it bounced across the cement porch and down into an open drain. I looked at the freezer and at the drain and back at the freezer with my mouth open. Then I just burst out laughing. Somehow, it seemed hilarious. Probably wouldn't have been my response, but again, different situation. After 2 weeks of disasters, that was the topping. I guess I'd have to go to the store. While I was laughing and plans for supper were going through my head, I said, "Oh, please, God, give me a break." For some reason, I looked at the drain and there saw my key come to the top of the standing water. Now, I don't know much about physics, but metal does not float on water. Now, Mr. Wagamuth's an engineer, but he's a light engineer, but I think he can tell me. Most all of us don't have to be an engineer to know that metal does not float on water. There at the top of the standing water, big side up. With two fingers, I reached in to retrieve it. I said, "Thanks, Father," and finished cooking supper. So you begin to see an examples here of praying and response. As an end result of the praying and response are what? Our faith is built. These are the disciplines that build our faith. All of us have those examples that we can look to down through the times of our lives to see how our faith has been built as an end result of what we have prayed for, what we have fasted for, the times when we have given of tithe and offering, and we did not expect financial rewards, but those financial rewards came back to us. Sometimes the financial rewards are just making that dollar stretch further than we simply say, "I don't know how this works. That I've been able to pay everything, and on paper it doesn't seem to make sense, but I'm always able to take care of all of my expenses, all of my bills." So as we think about those things, let's now zero in on the eighth point to ponder that we talked about earlier, and that was "thy will be done," or what we refer to as the will of God. I'm going to better word this a little bit for the purpose of the rest of the sermon, because this is where we're going to be dealing with the will of God. And that is to word it this way: coming to an understanding of the will of God in so many difficult situations. You know, when we're dealing with something and we come to understand the will of God in the difficult situations, it helps us deal with the situation itself. Sometimes that can take some time to understand the will of God in a difficult situation. If you're like me, it can be a situation in which years later, it's revealed to you why the situation happened the way that it did. You don't know. At the moment in time, you're not really sure. It's fuzzy. It can't be clear, but in faith, you say, "Okay, there's a reason for it. God just simply hasn't revealed it yet." But understanding the will of God in a difficult situation, that's where we move from this concept of human faith to a godly faith. Notice over in 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. Let's take a look at verse 14 and 15. 1 John chapter 5, beginning here in verse 14. He says, "Now this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us." Now, there's the precursor right away. In verse 14, he says, "Whatever we ask of him," caveat, "according to his will, he hears us." Verse 15, "And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we have asked of him." In other words, if I ask something according to his will, I don't have to doubt that it will be done. I simply have to understand what his will is. And Ephesians 5 verse 17 tells us that we must come to understand what the will of God is. Some of those are simple. Some of them are basic. But quite honestly, brethren, some are sorted out by time and circumstances. And we don't always know right away. As I said before, the time frame that God will deliver something is sorted out by his time and not our time. In either case, whether it's simple or basic, or whether it's taking longer and sorted out by time and circumstance, in either case, if we know that our relationship grows stronger by he will reward us openly, then it deepens our faith in him to face the greater trials and tests in our life. My point being here is that through time, if we have faced the trials and tribulations, whatever they might have been early on in our existence after baptism, that as we go through life and those challenges get greater and greater and greater, our faith should have grown deeper and deeper and deeper to help us face those greater trials. The journey to the top, if I can use that analogy, is going to get more and more difficult before you get to the top of the peak. You've been at it longer. You're more tired. You're worn out. But you come to a greater understanding of what is needed and what is necessary in order to make it to the top, because you have faced challenges along that way, making it up that mountain. That's what keeps you going. Notice over in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, he says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." So what Paul is telling us here is that we have to prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And the way that we do that is to transform our mind from the human reasoning that we have and moving to the godly reasoning that we need to have. That takes time. That takes building of this relationship we have with the Creator of the universe. And it cannot be done that we'd simply renew this relationship or renew the transforming of our mind on a monthly basis, a yearly basis. Well, I'll do it 2 weeks before Passover. I've renewed my mind for another year. If that's our mentality, then we are losing out the benefit of truly understanding the will of God more fully and completely. And I would dare say that we will not fully understand the will of God. It is something that must be done daily. The renewing of our mind is something that must be done daily. And how do we do that? We prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Well, how do you prove that? What does that mean, prove? You prove by testing. We test God, He tests us. In either case of testing, God helps us to sort out and understand His will. Now, this word prove in the Greek is the Greek word dokimazo. You don't need to know that, what that word is. All you need to know is what it means. It means to test. It means to prove with the expectation of approving. I'm testing something with the expectation of approving. By the context of the scripture, we see that there is a renewing of the mind. This is a what's referred to in the Greek as the present progressive language. Our mind was just not simply renewed at baptism and it stayed at that condition and we've never had to renew it again. The present progressive is an ongoing development of understanding the greater will of God over time, over circumstances and situations that happen and occur. That's why we go through the tests and the trials that we go through. I look at everything that's happened in the last 5 months in this nation, in this world, and I'm saying, we are being tested. What's my attitude in the middle of this testing? You know, God could have taken away this trial. He could have taken it away in a minute, but He didn't. Why? Submit to you that He is testing all of us. We are coming to a greater understanding of the will of God over time, over circumstances, over situations. We've had to do things differently this year in terms of Passover, in terms of the Holy Days, in terms of the Feast of Tabernacles. But what's our attitude through it all? And do we greatly or greater understand the will of God over this period of time going through what we've gone through? Do we understand that? Again, we have to come to understand certain things. You don't need to turn there. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. The statement in Scripture by the Apostle Paul is, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new. That's the way it should read. It is an old way of thinking that must be taken away. The thinking of our will imposed to the will of God. They are contrary to each other. We want it to get to the point where the will of God is what our will is. We're in unison together. That's what we want. That's what Paul's talking about here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, that you prove, test me. That's what he said in Malachi chapter 3 when he says, test me. You've robbed me in tithe and offerings. Test me and see if I won't do this. If you tithe and give me offering. Test me if you think that if you don't give me money that I won't fill your storehouses, that they're overflowing. Test me to the point where I will take care of the devourer. He will no longer devour your crops. That's the point. Testing. Coming to a better understanding. We renew our mind and this time-tested process where we come to understand the acceptable and perfect will of God. It takes time. Now, what I want us to do is tie the points together that we've talked about here in terms of testing and coming to the point of understanding the will of God with an Old Testament example. Let's turn over to Judges chapter 6. In Judges chapter 6, we find the story of one of God's servants by the name of Gideon. Now, we all remember Gideon. We often remember Gideon from the standpoint of the wet fleece and the dry fleece. Make the fleece wet, make the ground dry, and I'm with you. God does it, and then, well, you know, don't be angry with me, but let's reverse it this time. I just need to make sure. What we're going to see is, in essence, what Gideon was doing was he was trying to find out what the will of God was. Now, we see that as a lack of faith, and perhaps in certain respects it is. Maybe he should have the first time out said, okay, good, we're ready to go. Maybe he shouldn't have asked at all. But he was testing. He was trying to grow in faith through this whole process after God told him that he was going to be using him. We see an example throughout the entire story of Gideon about how he did these things speaking to God, and he was rewarded what? He was rewarded openly by the events that would take place. He's having this conversation with the angel of the Lord talking about the fleece being wet and the ground being dry. Nobody else knows that. But they can see, wow, what happened here? Gideon was rewarded openly. And by doing so, he became able to understand and know the perfect will of God. It's an interesting story when you take a look at it. What if you were told that you were going to save Israel from the vast hordes of the Midianites with only 300 men? We're going to take a look at the scripture that says that their armies were innumerable as the sand on the seashore, and they had more camels than they could count. And you're going to wipe them all out with 300 men. Come on, you got to be kidding me. 300 men? What if you were told that those 300 men would save the nation with only trumpets and torches as their weapons? Are you kidding me? That's what Gideon had to come to understand as he was led to the will of God. Let's begin here in Judges chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. The children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them, destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number. Remember that statement, without number. And they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. You know, it's a constant example of Israel. They, because of their sin, they were delivered into the hands of the Midianites. And they would cry out to God, and God would raise up a servant who would deliver them. They'd be delivered, then pretty soon they'd sin again, and They'd be delivered into the hands of another enemy. They'd cry out to God, and God would raise up another servant to deliver them. It was this constant cycle. It's a constant cycle. We love you, God. We don't like you, God. We love you, God. We don't like you, God. We love you, God. We don't like you, God. Please help us, God. We love you, God. I mean, it's just over and over and over again. It's a constant cycle. So here we were. They had because of their sin, they're delivered into the hands of the Midianites. They and their camels, as were stated, were too innumerable. Remember that point. Destroyed the crops, left no food for Israel. So again, God is going to send a prophet, and he's going to promise deliverance. Notice beginning in verse 7. It came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice." Sort of like going back in history, saying, okay, folks, this is the history. This is what you've done. This is what I've done. This is what you've done. And you haven't been good people. You haven't done what I said to do. You haven't done what I wanted you to do. So he is going to use Gideon. It's interesting when you read the story of Gideon. I won't necessarily go there, but in verse 11, it talks about the fact that God refers to, or the angel of the Lord refers to, this man Gideon as a mighty man of valor, as he's in the thrashing floor of the basement of this, you know, barn, because he's afraid of the Midianites, because they're marauders, they're rough folks. Here he's being referred to as a mighty man of valor, but we'd refer to him in certain respects as that looks more like a fraidy cat. He seems to be afraid. He doesn't want to be seen. He's fearing for his life. But notice verse 17, as again, the angel of the Lord appears, says, "Gideon, I want you. You're going to be the one to deliver Israel." Verse 17, "Then he said to him," this is Gideon speaking, "if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me." In other words, I hear this angel, but I'm not really sure it's you. I'm not really sure this is a communication that's coming from the Creator. I'm not really sure it's God. I need to be shown. So notice verse 18, "Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I will wait until you come back." So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat, unleavened bread from an ephah of flour, the meat he put in a basket, he put on the broth in a pot, and he brought them out under the terebinth tree and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread, lay it there on the rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire arose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread, and the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. So you got a supernatural miracle that occurs here. Verse 22, "Now Gideon perceived," and that word in the word in the Hebrew perceived means he discerned. It means, in the Hebrew, it means to see. He realized, yeah, this was actually the angel of the Lord. This was the angel of God that was speaking to me. "Now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord, so Gideon said, 'Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face.'" So Gideon realized he was the messenger of God. Let's move forward in the story to verse 27. Verse 27. "So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord had said, and because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do by day, he did it by night." What was he going to do? He's going to be tearing down the altar of Baal. So he grabs these 10 men. There's, you know, again, you go back to the point here, he had faith going, yeah, it's the angel of the Lord. He says, okay, I want you to destroy that altar. Okay, we'll do it. But let's do it at night because I'm afraid they might see us. Well, if God wanted you to do it, don't you think he would have protected you? But you see where he was still struggling. Gideon was still having to struggle with his faith. He had openly seen God had rewarded him openly by saying, okay, you want to know it's me? You want to know it's the angel of God talking to you? This is what happened. This is what occurred. But he still had a problem here. I'm going to tear down this altar, but I am to do it at night because, boy, I don't want them to see us. Verse 28, "And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image that was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar. which had been built. So they said to one another, "Who has done this thing?" And when they inquired and asked, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down." Therefore, on that day, he called him Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him because he has torn down his altar. So again, in his faith, he stepped down and he tore down that altar. He was attacked for it. But again, as I said before, when you see the opening start of this sort of scene within the life of Gideon, you recognize that he still did it at night. He still feared. He still feared. Notice verse 34. Let's pick the story up in verse 34. "But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, then he blew the trumpet, and the Abizarites gathered behind him." So the Spirit of God comes upon him. Keep in mind, it was faith that had led Gideon to this point. Everything we've read to this point, it was faith that had brought Gideon to this point. The offering that had been burned up, the supernatural experience, the miracle that occurred with the staff being lit and burning up the meat and the unleavened bread, the situation where he says, "I'll be with you," tearing down that altar, and again, they wanted to attack him, they wanted to kill him, but his life was spared. So everything, we're still dealing with faith in Gideon's life, but these instances where he's openly being rewarded for his faith by doing what God told him to do, and that faith is being built. Now let's move to verse 36. "So Gideon said to God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you shall save Israel by my hand, as you have said.' And it was so, when he rose early in the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece a bowl full of water." Verse 39, "Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not be angry with me.'" Now, again, that's an interesting statement. It's a precursor to say, I know you're going to be angry with me, so don't be angry with me when I ask you this particular request. But of everything that had happened to this point, you would think, well, if this had happened, Gideon, you saw God do that. If this had happened and he spared your life, he told you to tear down the altar and you tore it down, they were going to kill you, and he intervened and he saved you. If you asked him to do what you did there by make it dry on the ground and make the fleece wet, isn't that enough? Not for Gideon. Then Gideon, verse 39, "Do not be angry with me, but let me speak just one more. Let me test, I pray, just one more with the fleece. Let it be dry only on the ground, but on all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew all around the ground. Do you see something about God and his response here? God could have said, "Gideon, haven't I done enough? Don't you think I've done enough at this particular point?" But I'm sure God said, "Okay. Not enough? Okay." This was the ultimate will of God. What is going to lead him to is a realization and a need for confirmation. Again, Gideon had to be rewarded openly. He had to be shown openly. He prayed to God in private. He prayed to God in secret. He beseeched God privately, but God rewarded him openly by making the fleece wet, making the ground dry, reversing it the second time through. He had to be shown that. But God is not through yet. Notice Judges chapter 7. Let's continue the story. Judges chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Jerubbaal, that is, Gideon and all the people who were with him, rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them on the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" So here we find a situation where Gideon is being given a glimpse of God's will. And God is saying, "My will here is that they understand the glory of me and not themselves. I don't want Israel to think that they're the big tough guy, the big man on campus. I don't want them to think they're the big bully and they can just do it and all, and they've done it for themselves. You got too many people here. We're going to have to pare this down." Verse 3. Now, therefore, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and only 10,000 remained. How'd you like to be Gideon at that particular moment in time? After you had read about these camels that were too innumerable, as we're going to read in a moment, that the army had, there was so many members of the army that it was like the sand on the seashore. It was too innumerable to count. How'd you like to be Gideon saying, you know what, Gideon, if they want to leave, tell them to get out of here. If you're fearful, get out. 22 of them left, 22,000, and only 10 remained. Verse 4, the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you, and of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. I mean, here we find a situation where there's 10,000. And God says, it's still too many. This is so unorthodox. But again, we go back to what? It is the will of God that Israel would understand that he is the one to deliver them, not themselves. He's showing Gideon his will. Now, Gideon at that particular point said, this is just crazy. He could have said, this is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. But what we find here is he went along with it. We find what they had to do. They had to lap the water a certain way. He's going to pare everybody down to 300. Notice again, God is going to show Gideon his will as they march down the road. Notice in verse 9, chapter 7 and verse 9. It says, it happened the same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down and go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. He still had some fears, Gideon. So he took his servant. But again, God understood that and he knew that. And in verse 10, he says, if you're afraid to go down, take your servant with you. Take your servant with you. Verse 12, then the Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And you've got 300 men. Gideon really came to understand what God had in mind. Notice verse 13. When Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and it struck it so that it fell and overturned and the tent collapsed. Then his companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, into his hand. God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hands. Notice the progression in thinking in Gideon's mind. He didn't have to see anything. There was a dream. He heard the interpretation and he said, God has delivered the people of Midian to us. We will destroy them. Do you see how his faith was built? But through that period of time, he simply had to assess a situation in which God could reinforce that by rewarding him openly. These acts that happened and occurred were not in secret. His requests and his petitions that he made to the angel of the Lord were in private, but God rewarded him openly. Verse 19. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in the hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets, broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hand, the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and fled, cried out and fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. And the army fled. You see where it fled into those various areas. Verse 23, and the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh and pursued the Midianites. What an incredible situation. God creates confusion, and this massive army is broken into small pieces, and that army begins to kill itself because they don't realize that it's their own men. This massive army is destroyed again by God. But Gideon had to be brought to that particular moment through the events that would occur before they ever got to the point of 300 faithful that would stand with Gideon to fight the Midianites. But he had to get there through understanding the will of God and understanding what God wanted. So what do we learn from that particular point? As we go through these understanding of the spiritual disciplines, we come to understand what the will of God is. You see, God's will is supreme. And we find that through the disciplines that we are instructed by Jesus Christ of in Matthew chapter 6. He tells us the right way to enter into those disciplines and how they are to be done. As we follow Jesus Christ's admonition through the disciplines of giving, of prayer, and of fasting, God helps us prove through time and through circumstances and conditions what is the good and acceptable and perfect will. His good and acceptable perfect will. He tells us to go and do these things in private. And then by rewarding us openly, he brings us to a more full and complete understanding of his will.